On this week's show, the joy in solving problems with John Price.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started The Contech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in Contech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's Contech Crew time.
All right, Jacob, what is happening? Seems like we have some noise going on in your area there. You're looking around. Are we gotta worry about anything over there today?
Just low-flying helicopter. So I wonder where it's going and what it's doing. But once again, keep recording if the SWAT comes in and takes me out, okay?
Oh, absolutely. We are going to use that clickbait like nobody's business. John and I were talking about it when you were checking it out. He's like, maybe we should hang up. I'm like, I need that. Everybody loves a good clickbait these days. So if I had them dragging you out, we know nothing.
Right?
We have deniability. So everybody say hi to John. John, how you doing, man?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I am great. We are going to have fun. We're going to dive in, learn more about the joy that John's talking about, and maybe get a little geeky along the way. But before we do, y'all remember now we're out on youtube.com/@TheContechCrew. Check us out. That's where we're dropping new episodes, dropping new shorts. Follow us on social media. You know, it takes a group. So everybody follow all the guests and all the hosts.
Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the Contech Crew. That's right. We're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@thecontechcrew.com to learn more.
All right. So, John Price, I am outnumbered right now by BIM nerds. And you can just tell, by the way, if you guys don't know how to tell a BIM nerd, just listen for their keyboard and you'll know it's them. So, John, talk a little bit about how we got here and your BIM nerdiness.
Oh, man. Very indirect and non-traditional is what I'll say. I have been into sort of drafting and design my entire career. After high school, I didn't really jump straight into college to do something. I just wasn't really sure what to do. I decided I was going to just go. I saw an engineering design graphics sort of program, and that just kind of blew the doors off of anything that I was going to end up doing in the future. We started getting our hands on drafting and modeling tools in there, and that was it. Like, I knew somehow, some way, I wanted to make sure that I was using those tools. I got a job as a drafter when I was like 19. I've been using AutoCAD and those types of tools for a very, very long time. Decided I wanted to get into engineering. So I actually went back to school and got a mechanical engineering degree, where I was able to leverage a lot of the drafting and modeling practices as tools for like projects and things like that. And, you know, that was a big leg up. But then I just kind of kept building off of that. So like the tools, the modeling has always sort of been a part of that. And in addition, sort of the love of the technology that enabled me to be able to draft and model. And so as I was working for various organizations, I would say, you know, there's ways we can leverage these tools to kind of enable better interaction, integration, and Revit was getting hot. You know, 2009, I was doing CAD work at a company called Bellamed, and they do capital equipment for hospitals, which is, you know, that's kind of the big ticket item. And working with a lot of A&E firms, architects, and they were like, hey, if you give us content inside of Revit, we can spec you in and it make things easier as these projects progress. And I was like, guys, I know I got a plan. Let's do this. And so I requested Revit and they said, let's do it. So we started building out templates and things. And it was very high level for me at first. It was all about the pretty stuff, right? Visualization and that kind of thing. And then it started to roll into the technical side of things. Jump ahead a little bit. I was more leveraging my mechanical engineering degree for a little while, still doing modeling and types of things like that for manufacturing of like steel panels, armored vehicles for the DOD, that sort of thing. And somebody came up while we were doing projects for the DOD with 3D modeling tools. And they said, hey, you guys are doing a lot of 3D stuff. We have a building that we need in 3D. Can you model it in 3D? And I was like, well, yeah. And they were like, can you model it in SolidWorks? And I said, no, you can't. But I'll tell you what you can do. And then I kind of reintroduced BIM as the concept for the DOD, specifically the Navy. And it just kind of blew up from there. They said, well, whatever you need, do it. We'll give you a team, software, let's go. And so it kind of took off from there. And there's a lot of bumps and bruises learned from trying to implement at such a large organization that's so heavily matrixed and so layered with process and things to like get tools, get people, get resourcing, get everybody aligned, and put all of that stuff together. Did that for about 6-7 years, and then made the transition over to Boeing, where I am today. I came over with the specific task of leading the BIM transformation effort for their global real estate and facilities organization. And that has somehow morphed into more of a technology leadership role for engineering tools, not just BIM, but within that ecosystem, simulation and analysis, things that engineers need to be able to perform the work that they need to do. So that is a long, rambling summary that I hope ended where we needed it to.
Yeah, I love it. I love it because you went through a lot of the early bumps and bruises and phases of this process in BIM, in CAD. And interestingly enough, like a lot of people are still going through that. So talk a little bit about some of those early bumps and bruises. Like talk to your old self who's sitting there driving down the road right now thinking, all right, we still use CAD and we're going to go down this road. What are the problems I'm going to run into? What are the things that these barriers that you need to take down before you get there?
Probably the biggest one that sticks out is the mindset and the paradigm shift from drafting to model-based technology. If you go to any large, well-established organization that has been in drafting their whole lives, they speak drafting, they think in terms of drafting, they think in terms of this, then this, as opposed to a more parallel approach. And the data layer is missing in a lot of that type of thing. And so I think the key thing that I would probably go back and tell myself is you need to focus on more heavily on education and ensuring terminology and an understanding the language. So I think those things are key components that really drive speed to implementation. A lot of the feedback that I receive, is we've got challenges here. It's just miscommunication, right? And so it's the language piece, and that just comes with education.
It's interesting, right? Because I wouldn't have thought of, and I don't think we talk about it enough, that it is really almost learning a complete new language. You know, we think of it as, oh, we're just going from 2D to 3D, but you're not. You're actually completely speaking a different language and implementing different processes. Like you said, CAD has a layering that it has to go through, a linear process versus modeling, which has more of a that parallel process you're talking about. So I don't think people give that enough time. How did you, I'm sure you stumbled on that, but, and I'm sure it wasn't easy. But what maybe was some of the aha moments in there of like, oh, I need to, like, we've heard this a couple times, like certain words just mean different things.
Yeah. There's a whole stack of scars back there. I'm going to try and pull up something more specific, but I do know. So like just recently, as a matter of fact, thinking in terms of drafting versus like somebody told me, well, I can't submit a model for permitting. And I was like, hold on, like we're missing some things here. And that was a lesson learned. Like, well, we're not flipping the table completely over. You still derive your drawings from the model. It's just how it's located. It's how you consolidate things. So I was like, all right, so one, everybody just thinks we're moving to 3D and good luck, everybody else. And I was like, wait. So there's a level setting that didn't happen to a certain level there. Other folks are very concerned about the transition period and how can we still get our drawings in AutoCAD while using Revit? And again, that's a misunderstanding, right? Well, we're not going to do that, but you're going to be equipped with the training and the tools necessary to access what you need to access. It's going to look different from a mechanics perspective, but from an output perspective, you're going to see not only what you have continued to see, but you're going to see an improved process and product that goes alongside that type of thing. Other things are a little bit more technically nuanced, just in the use of the tools. Folks are going, well, how do you manage layers in Revit and things like that? And you're like, wait, no, different. That's the paradigm piece, right? We're not dealing with that because it's the real virtual representation of the object. So layers kind of come out of play. Things like that. Just stuff that when you have a meeting and then you get the flood of questions afterwards, or things kind of just nosedive into chaos because people are panicking because they're used to getting things a certain way. Those are the lessons that I've been able to kind of, oh, these are the recognition points that I need to make sure that I address early on so I can at least get through what I'm communicating.
That's awesome. Jacob?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you really saw opportunities and pushed it into there. You mentioned, you know, hey, we could do this in 3D. We could do it better. Here you go. And then as you went along that, you learned, I got to be a translator too. I have to learn that, all right, this is a great solution right here. We could use 3D. We could really get something good out of it. But then nobody understands the language. You're now speaking a completely different language. So now you're translating as well. Do you mentioned data as part of that and going back? Is that another translation now? Are we in this point where 3D became, okay, we understand that language now. And now everybody's like, hey, there's data too. You should be paying attention to the data. And I feel like there is a pushback on that as well. That's the, we don't want to put it all in the model, or we don't want to, you know, have to track data, but we see the opportunity and the solution. It's just people don't understand. Are you seeing that too?
Yeah, I am. That's going to be another major translation phase, if you will, because now you have folks that are paying attention to data, but they're paying attention to data almost in a silo. And so we're looking at, you know, I've had talks with several organizations that have done, you know, they're like, well, we're going to get our assets into this program and we're going to do projects in this program and we're going to make sure that we have good data and we're going to, you know, make sure that it's consumable by everyone at various levels and things. But I don't know how many folks, I mean, now it's a kind of all over the place. So I think more and more folks are leaning towards that, but we're during the transition, I'm not entirely sure how many folks are looking at connecting those data streams to one focal point that you can use to tell the holistic picture. I think there's danger in creating silos that are more highly technical for the solution, as opposed to merging those silos into one trunk of information for the solution.
Go a little deeper on that one. I need to, because this one hasn't come up before, and I think I am understanding what you're saying, but because we all want this like one spot, but are you talking about there's not one spot, or we need to think about storing data in one spot and accessing it from different programs?
I don't know that storing data in one spot, at least in my experience near term, is realistic. I think the source of truth translates with time. I think it changes. So, you know, for projects, the source of truth may be your model up to a point, but when the project completes, your asset information is going to translate out of that model into your configuration management platform, your CMMS tool, which then is going to be the source of truth for your asset management. That's where your work orders and things come in and out of, your warranty information. And then from there, if you need to do something like query your database or something, maybe that's a third, more O&M focused source of truth that connects operational data to static asset information And then you have your models and your drawings and things. I don't know that it's going to be in one spot. I think the aggregation of that data is what's critical. Figuring out how you pull those things together, how you standardize what things are called, how you structure that data, and how you display that information. So the silos can still kind of be there in the back end, I guess. You have your towers, I guess we'll call them. But you need a place to pull the right information in so that you have that unified, holistic picture. And that's a translational thing. I think a lot of folks are focusing on the technology transition that gets you those towers, but not necessarily looking beyond to the holistic aggregation of the information that comes out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that continues the conversation about like speaking their own language. Each of those towers is basically a different language, because even if you go and talk to the people that own those towers, they're only concerned about certain things. And the data that's inside of their towers only represents their concerns. But we can't tell them, hey, we're going to throw it into this big pot and you're going to have to go get your data a certain way from everybody else's data too. They want it simplified. They want to keep out the same process that they've been doing. Now, standards, I mean, it's tough to do that, because if we're looking at standardization, now you're looking at almost a new standard or a standard that becomes this thick on how each of those silos work and then how it translates so we can actually talk to each other. Are you, I mean, I first met you when you were doing the Navy stuff and you were working on a BIM standard there for them. I mean, have you seen that actually work and go through, or is it, I think everybody else has always stubbed their toe and waited for the next standard, and then we just kind of get 100 different standards.
Is it, can I say kind of both?
Yeah,
definitely toe stubbing is a part of that. I'd say we gave our best shot and it was functional, but there was still more that could have been done in terms of not producing the novel and making things simplified enough for us to be able to act on. So semi-complete, partially successful. It would be good to iterate off of, I would say.
Well, and that's kind of what you have to end up doing, especially when it comes to that amount of data, that amount of change, and that amount of silos, right? Those silos growing upward, at this point, we're kind of looking at them as difficult, but they were important growth for the industry. That was capturing the data, and now it's deciding what the raw materials are that need to flow between them and how they need to sort of be distilled to each one. And that requires a level of standard, a level of rigor, and it's a lot of people speaking a lot of languages, and that in and of itself becomes difficult. And, you know, maybe we never get all the way where it's perfect. We're not probably never going to get there, but we're going to get places where you can do more. And I think that's where, you know, kind of where you are today, John, is so interesting, because, you know, we open this with joy. Throughout this process, you've learned different tools, different data sets, different architectures, but really you're really enjoying solving new problems now in different ways. And talk a little bit about where you're at today and how these lessons brought you to the point where you actually said joy twice in the pre-call. So I'm going to make you say it again here.
The joy comes from, I'm going to say people. It's the relationships piece. And it's not just that. It's leveraging people that already speak those languages, that already have their own areas of influence, that already have their requirements, their understanding, all of these types of things, and saying, all right, what is the goal here? What do we need? And then being able to rapidly leverage my network and saying, all right, we need this person, and this person. And then you create this Venn diagram of excellence, right? And then suddenly now we're talking, and we're not just talking in the theoretical, we're talking in the tactical. Like we're how are we going to do this? Who else needs to be involved here? What is required? Pulling those teams together and just watching the sparks kind of start to fly and us really starting to dig into what's needed, not just from like a tool perspective, but like from a process perspective. You know, how are we going to make sure that we're not just slapping a tool on it like a Band-Aid and hoping for the best? You know, those things, I really, really enjoy the process of that. I love being able to go, I know a guy, I know a lady. Let's put them together. Let's get this thing situated and then let it go. Like, that's my thing. I love that.
Well, it's the power of innovation, right? It's about understanding people's differences and different perspectives and not saying, well, oh, the, you know, and I might have you give me some examples of the different, you know, roles those people play, but it's like, oh, well, we can't put the legal in with, with the accountants because, you know, legal doesn't speak money and, you know, that we don't talk that way. It's like, actually, no, that's really important. Like their differences are their powers. It's how do you give them a common ground? So talk a little bit about like maybe some of those types of groups, what they represent and what kind of sparks are flying.
Yeah, sure. So when I look to deploy a technology, one, there's already a requirement that's been met or made that's been communicated. I need to speak to that person, understand what their requirement is. But with that, there's always going to be some form of leadership approval element there. There's going to be some form of technical infrastructure, IT related person involved in that. There's going to be timelines associated with it. What are costs associated with that type of thing? And so you've got to sort of pull all of these folks together and act as the nerve center to start with, to identify who's who in the zoo, right? And then and then when you get that, like that's so more often than not, I see the requester, because they're the ones that tell you how to use the tool or how they what the use case is for that specific tool. Then you have leadership to go, yes, that's a valid component, but not just that, we have to leverage whether or not it could be used. Is it standard or non-standard? Is it something we need at the enterprise level, or is it something that's a one-off situation? And then the question becomes, should it be used if it is non-standard? What's the requirement at this site if it is not an enterprise level request? You know, then you have to say, well, what needs to happen in order to procure this? We need dollars. We need IT resources to ensure that we have a means to deploy it in a way that is simple and efficient. We need to make sure that we have a way to track it. And so there's people in all of these positions that can, like, I don't know that. So like, I have to know who to go to. Like, that's not me. So I need to know where to plug these people in. And then, but my job is, in my opinion, my job is to own it and aggregate it to ensure that it doesn't stagnate. Because then you end up with folks that are like, we can't do anything. We can't get anything. So all sorts. So speaking the technical language of the engineers, being able to speak the IT language, being able to speak finance, being able to speak strategically with leadership, all of those things come into play that, you know, from my perspective.
Yeah, a lot of different languages, a lot of different moving parts and pieces. And, you know, you said this earlier, you have some influence in that. But you don't, you said you've got to go up the chain. So what was your sort of quote for that?
You have to be able to influence without authority, because ultimately, what did I say? Authority is good, but that's how you get people to do what you want them to do. But if you influence them, they themselves want to do it. And so that's how you sort of influence the culture of an organization, for one, which is super important. But two, that's also how you drive sort of and energize the activities and the initiatives. And so you give people skin in the game and you influence that way, and the results will speak for themselves, in my experience.
Yeah, that energy, because you're bought into the process. That's the key. Is, and I like this because we've had this, oh, should it be top down? Should it be bottom up? I like this side hustle. Right. Like, I'm the side influencer. I'm just influencing, you know, I know these hurdles. Oh, you have this hurdle. Like, I know to go to talk to IT, and I can talk to them about scalability. I can talk to them about security. Yes, it has these things. I already know it does. Like, you can pull out your checklist, and I've already, you know, I'm not bringing you something that's going to fail on the first check. Right. And so I've got a level of influence with them. Now they trust me. My end users, my engineers, they have a level of trust with me. And my leaders now have seen me pull this off. And so they have a level of trust. So you're creating this trust matrix that then people come to you and they're like, we are going to actually get something done. And then they get excited and you're not doing it anymore, right? You're plugging the parts and pieces, but they're doing it and you're getting joy from watching their jobs get better. I would never say easier because people, that's a mistake. Technology does not make our jobs easier. It makes them better. We're better at them. We can do things faster, those kinds of things. It's not always faster. It's maybe more accurate. It's maybe more valuable. So, Jacob, I'm stealing them here because this is fun, man.
I'm chomping at the bit right now. And really, I'm going to talk to the listeners right now. If you are a BIM person and you have been in the industry and you see struggle, or if you're really young into the industry too, re-listen to that because there were some really important things of that trust network. Jeff, we even had the conversation, I think it was with Caitlin a few weeks ago, and we talked about selling and getting people on board and ensuring that it's going, where BIM people, I guarantee you, this was me when I started when I was younger. We know the end user and we know IT. We don't know the leadership and we don't know the financing. And by knowing those two, we're able to crack the code and put it in and just deploy, right? We can go in there. I already did the plugins. Don't worry about it. I went ahead and went around the firewall. Don't worry. But we weren't ever able to produce the business case and say, this is what I want. I really enjoy the fact that John's like, I didn't need to produce it. I needed that trusted advisor in finance and that trusted advisor in leadership to say, hey, leadership, what are you looking for to sell this? Finance, how do we put this together so we can show that there is a return and that we keep going with it? I think that's huge as so many people continue to stub their toe trying to get more and more involved, more and more technology, showing why it is. But maybe it's not the fact of, hey, we need to know everything and be able to do everything ourselves. How you build that trust network is a huge factor.
I'm also interested in where along that line did you learn to speak to those different folks? What, because John, you're talking to your BIM folks and your IT folks, the reason we're all pretty good at that is we all speak a semi-level of geek, right? But we all know, and I've done some research over the last year with some of our, you know, mechanicals and electricals and plumbers on just the fact that you're not speaking the language of business, the language of finance. Where'd you learn that along the way? How'd you pick that up to create that part of your network? Because it's a valuable skill.
Everything that I've learned has come from a hard lesson one way or the other. In terms of like IT, so like I am by no means an IT subject matter expert, but when you go to deploy a tool, so my ability to speak with IT regarding the requirements have come from just nightmarish challenges of getting tools deployed. What are things we care about? What are our security situations? Like, how do we get authority to operate? How do we make sure that we're moving things in line? Those are things that I got from the DOD. Shocking to probably nobody. They have stringent security protocols, which shouldn't surprise anybody. So how do you get them done when you yourself are not the one managing and deploying licenses? Well, you got to talk to these people. And then I found out that when you submit tickets go to certain people who don't know what you're saying. So then you have to get better at communicating what you need in those tickets and then figure out who's answering those tickets. Get them on the phone. Explain in detail. Do a screen share. That way they can see what you're saying and then they can clarify what they're saying. And so I very vividly remember this. I spent tens of hours on the phone doing screen share. I had them come by my desk, like just building that type of communication. I don't think anybody else was doing it at the time. And they're like, this is helpful. I can get you what you need faster because you showed me what you need and how it should work. And I basically took that and templated it, and that's what happens now. So when I need to talk to leadership, I say in, you know, very clear terms, this is what's happening. What do you need in order to make sure that this is a clear understanding for you so that you can make decisions. You know, this is my recommendation, but what do you need from me in terms of business use case so that you have a valid base to make decisions off of? You know, it's that whole thing across the board, because there's been times where if you don't, it's on you ultimately. Like, it's an ownership thing. Like, but you ever talk to a director or a VP, they're busy. They don't have time for you to read an entire contextual white paper on why this is important, right? But at the same time, you need to be effective in the brief communication pieces that you have, because those rejections are where you're going to learn your lessons and what you missed last time. And so it's been that sort of thing. It's just, it's a hard uphill battle in large, heavily matrixed organizations. And so anytime I've gotten a turnaround or something, capturing those lessons learned and figuring out a different approach or an angle of attack is where you sort of build those skills, because it is a skill that can be learned and can be used to great effect. It's not something you have to be born with, really. It's just, you got to be stubborn.
Well, I love it. You got to be stubborn, but this is where we're trying to turn it around right now, because you're a pioneer, right? You came up through the ranks when Revit wasn't a thing, and it was the transformation from CAD to Revit and a number of those technologies and tools. And like you said before, kind of at the beginning, like, BIM's not just modeling anymore. It's an entire ecosystem of tools that have specific needs that create data, et cetera. So it's a wild world. I think leadership, people like you having learned this, you will be in leadership positions, should provide this type of knowledge and training to those people you're bringing up through the ranks. Like, as you're bringing in people to help you, you're like, listen, here's my template for IT, and here's how I talk to them and get them on board. Hey, here's how I talk to the VP of engineering to get dollars to do these projects. And remember, just saying, those people are busy and they don't want to hear geek. Because I got into an argument not too long ago with some folks about, you know, what's the problem with technology and construction? And I said, construction technologists are the problem, because we walk into the room and we're excited. We want to talk about VR. We want to talk about AR. We want to talk about,
we do,
you know, data deduplication and my data lakes and my nerdy this, and the eyes glaze over. And they roll back in their heads and they're like, oh, I am done with this. And by the way, that's why you end up reporting to the CFO, the office of no, because the CEO is like, I don't ever want to hear this geek speak again. You deal with them and make sure they don't go out of line with the budget. And that's why in a lot of our construction organizations and AEC organizations, IT reports up through the CFO, the office of no. And we need, on our end, to do exactly what you're doing, John, and learn how to speak the languages of each of those people and make our cases and have a respect that they're busy. Like, so that's one other thing that I don't hear enough of, is a respect for the perspective that that person is busy and is running a business and has a ton of other things they're worried about. And your little thing, although it might be the biggest thing in the world to you, might not be to them. So it's an awesome learning experience. But also, I wanted to dig back. You said something about your job is also to keep the ball rolling. And I think that is a huge component, because we hear about, you know, and I love, Jacob and I love to beat up on Excel showing up everywhere in the industry. It is the largest, you know, BIM tool in the industry. It's the largest project management tool, estimating tool. It's everything, right? There is a reason, though. The reason is people like you don't exist everywhere to keep projects moving forward. And when a project doesn't move forward, the solutioneers in our world pull out Excel and solve the problem, because it's a real problem, right? Like, they don't get to stop their jobs just because, you know, we haven't decided on a tool yet. So talk a little bit about how you keep that rolling and look for those sort of bottlenecks and problems.
Just get real awkward with the communication is what I'm really good at. So silence presents opportunity, in my opinion. So when things are going, so let's say we have a project, a technology project or something, and we send a request out, or if somebody sends a request in, let's just say we have a project team and we're working on it. And then a question gets asked and then like a day goes by, 2 days go by, 3 days go by. Nobody knows how to answer it. Everybody's kind of doing the whole Spider-Man meme. Fingers are pointing all over the place and nobody needs to do anything. I view that as a chance and a requirement to step in and say, all right, so given this, we need to understand these things. Who are the people, if they're not on this email, that need to weigh in on this? Like, I just playing the role of catalyst to reignite things that have gone stale, either due to lack of visibility or simply I don't know. But I don't know is not justification for ignoring the actual ask or the situation. And so just by poking it a little bit and then being willing to step up into that awkward silence has been, it's a key piece in my view of where I'm at with this. Like anytime you're leading a transition, even if it's not your area of expertise, you still have to lead. So you may have to make the awkward phone call. You may have to hop into Teams and go, hey, sorry, you've never met me before, but this is what we're working on. Can you point me in the right direction? Getting into the email thing, like I cannot tell you how many times I have done that. And guess what? I have no problem reaching out to these people now. Like they are a part of my network and they also reach out to me. Area of influence expanded, moving into new realms here. Now I have, you know, it's bi-directional, but you got to do it.
I love it. Jacob, we're going to let him drop that mic right
there. I was going to say, but there's no more.
Drop that mic. John, thank you so much for sitting down today and talking to us. It was awesome. It was really cool. And thank you both for not banging on the mechanical keyboards. Too bad. Maybe in an episode later near you. John, thanks so much, man. Jacob, as always, you bring the good ones. I enjoy it. I enjoy our mornings. I hope the helicopters are gone and you stay safe over there.
All right. Till next time, Jeff.
And thank you for tuning in today to geek out for our interview with John Price. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is the Contech Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.